This is the Big Shift for Small Farms podcast. G'day listeners, I'm your host Edgars Grestet. If you're looking to make a change or just try something new, we've got you covered. Each episode we talk to farmers who've been there, done that, and some who are just dipping their toe in and having a go. So whether you're in the kitchen or out in the tractor, it's time for the Big Shift. Welcome to another special edition of the Big Shift podcast, focusing on climate adaptation. I'm here with my co-pilot, Matt Pierce.
Here we are again.
On the road again. I can't wait to get back on the road again. But this is not the karaoke hour. We are here to focus on biodiversity and ecosystem services today. Very exciting episode. We're going to visit a vineyard, macadamia farm, and we're going to finish off with cherries. We're just sort of bucket listing all of Matt's favorite foods. What's important when it comes to thinking about biodiversity?
So I guess, you know, biodiversity is essential for all ecosystem functions, be it in the natural environment or on a productive farm. And climate change is having significant impacts on biodiversity through increasing intensity of fires, storms, and periods of drought. So farmers attempting to maintain these healthy ecosystems and improve the biodiversity on their properties through using things like regenerative practices or native plantings, introducing cover crops and focusing on improving the soil microbiology, using practices like integrated pest management. So in this episode, we're going to be hearing from farmers who have improved their resilience by increasing their whole ecosystem biodiversity to improve the pest control, improve pollination, and the general resilience of their property.
Well, let's get on the road and go and visit our first farm. And once we've done some work, then we can have a glass of wine. So we're going to go and visit Tullock Wines now.
My name's Keith Tullock.
And I'm Alistair Tullock. We're here at Keith Tullock Wine in Pacolbin in the Hunter Valley. We're about 25 minutes from Singleton here.
Pacolbin is a very historic area that's been making wine since about 1823. And our family moved here and then started making wine in 1896.
We have a range of different wines that we create, some which are just grown on the property and made on site. We grow quite a lot of Semillon, and we're increasing our plantings of Chardonnay and Shiraz.
We produce about 8,000 cases of wine per year. We focus on small batch production from very select sites.
Growing up in a grape growing family, I was always in and around vineyards and winemaking. So from a very early age, I was out working in the vines and helping in the little ways that I could. Throughout my lifetime, the change in the climate's been really noticeable, and the way that grapevines react to climatic rather than specific weather events is actually quite telling. We're kind of going from the hottest, driest years to the wettest years on record, consistently back to back, on top of the long-term trends that the vines are reacting to in terms of the temperature accumulation, the shift in when we're harvesting grapes, the types of grapes we're harvesting, the chemistry of the grapes we're harvesting has changed quite dramatically. We're basically losing the winter, and grapevines are coming out of dormancy sooner and sooner, which means that they're exposed to the risk of a late frost. It's moving the harvest of the grape varieties closer together. We're used to picking most of the varieties through February and March, and now we're even picking in January. The biggest problem for us with viticulture is how to adapt these vineyards to these changing conditions in terms of high rainfall events and wet seasons, keeping downy mildew, powdery mildew, botrytis, all of these potential blights out of the vineyard. And in heatwave events, the irrigation of the vines, the application of sunscreen are really important tools that we use to try and make sure that vines don't enter heat stress.
Viticulture is such a sensitive industry, both economically and environmentally. The Tullocks seem to not only be dealing with the challenges, they seem to really be embracing them and seeing the opportunity to enhance their farming practices.
I guess what was exciting to see at Tullock Wines was the biodiversity garden beds that have been set up there. So they've Tulloch have been trying to increase the biodiversity in multiple ways on their farm. They've introduced these biodiverse beds that sit side by side their vineyard blocks. There's a creek system that curves through their blocks, and the riparian zones that are there already, they're trying to increase the sort of flowering species that exist in those. And then just within the blocks themselves, they're growing cover crops and trialing different types of like clovers and grasses and flowering species that can introduce beneficial insects that have then allowed them to completely cut out any use of pesticides.
Yeah, there are so many flow-on benefits when there's a real focus around enhancing biodiversity. Let's hear a little bit more from Alistair about some of the practices that they've implemented on the farm.
As the climate warms, we've had to react with changes in our viticulture. So that starts fundamentally from the ground up, literally, with soil health. So if we can increase the percentage of soil carbon, we can increase the water-holding potential of the soil, which also means that our plants are more resilient through heat waves and less reliant on irrigation than they otherwise would have been. By keeping the ground covered, we can really decrease erosions. And also, when the soil has more organic carbon, it tends to kind of bounce back and hold that moisture. And if we can use crops which sequester carbon into the soil to also sequester nitrogen, then that will become available for plants to utilise for their growth. So a huge array of benefits, really, not just for plants, but also for native flora and fauna. So how we've tried to improve the biodiversity on the property is it started in the riparian areas. Well, I wanted to really try and boost the number of native flowering species. In terms of a biodiversity rejuvenation goes, the riparian areas are very important. We have lots of these creek beds bordering our vineyards, and not only are planting native species and keeping the native species that are there healthy, but what we can actually do is create windbreaks around the vineyard. Having windbreaks, especially if it's with native species, is really going to help us to be more resilient in the future. So we started off by planting young trees and then trying to take a bit of a hands-off approach to the creeks, just letting the native trees that we'd established grow, but also the native grasses, and let everything come into balance. On top of that, we started working with the Department of Primary Industries to establish specific plant beds just beside vineyards so we could set insect traps and actually measure the benefits of certain flowering species within a certain proximity to vineyards. And we noticed a huge increase across 3 or 4 years of native species with these biodiversity beds. We've actually seen an elimination of pesticide in the vineyard due to the use of these garden beds, which harbour the kind of native insects which will predate on pests like light brown apple moth, which is a particularly bad pest in vineyards. So the establishment of the native garden beds just close by vineyards to promote beneficial native insects has completely eliminated pesticide use from the vineyard. So these are expensive sprays that we no longer have to put out. They're less tractor passes, less hours spent in the vineyard, less work to be done, but the same result. So it's been a really positive part of our farm management that's changed over the last 5 years. This is one of the garden beds we have with the native flowering species. This creates a beautiful little understory underneath the plants with flowering heads. We've got the eucalyptus coming up, the prickly leaf tea tree, all flowering through different times of the year too, so that we can sort of constantly harbour these native species and attract pollinators. So this dichondra has been really incredible outcome in terms of the soil health, the elimination of herbicides, and also vine performance. Sowing these cover crops, planting these native garden beds, planting native species, and using organic compost has resulted in really good vine vigour, increased yields, really good performance with the vines. So we're really trying to find a method of farming which helps us to rejuvenate the vines, but also the native landscape around us.
A lot of successful vineyards have a intergenerational story around them, and obviously we can hear that through the Tulloch, how they've really been focusing on environmental health, landscape health, business health, and it's gone down from generation to generation.
Vineyards and wine vines tend to be quite old. A lot of vines are 80 years plus. So these things have been planted generally well before a lot of people were even talking much about climate change. So the techniques that wine growers and vineyardists are having to integrate into their operations to managing the challenging conditions that climate change is bringing has been really interesting to explore. And
let's be honest, it was fun hanging out in a vineyard.
Yes.
Staying with biodiversity and moving from the vineyards, we're going to head to another farm called Malua Farm with Ross Arnott, who's a macadamia grower. He's doing some similar things around managing the landscape around his trees and under his trees.
Ross at his orchard Malua is introducing cover crops and a very diverse mix of species into the cover crops that sit between the rows of macadamia trees, but then also in the sort of surrounding areas, the borders of his farm. He's also introducing things like sunflowers and taller growing shrubs that can attract beneficial insects. And the main reason that macadamia nuts will get downgraded is that they get insect damage. And so he's trying to introduce beneficial insects that can combat those non-beneficial insects.
My name's Ross Arnett. I'm a macadamia farmer on the northern rivers of New South Wales. My farm, Malua, is about 15 minutes east of Lismore, and I've been here for 12 years farming full time. My macadamia farm is 10 hectares in size. There's 2,000 trees ranging in age from 18 years to 8 years. I've produced around about 3 tonnes a hectare at the moment, but that should climb up to closer to 5 tonnes when the farm is in full production. I use a regenerative ag process of farming where I'm using biological options rather than synthetic options. Yeah. They're planted in spacings of 10 by 5, which is quite big for macadamias. It allows a lot more light into the orchard, so I get good ground covers. The orchard comprises of 4 different varieties. Having 4 Hawaiian varieties helps with pollination and also season variability with nut production. The farm at the moment produces somewhere between 3 tonnes a hectare and will move up towards 5 tonnes as the trees become more mature. Over the years, I've seen a massive change in the environment, particularly the climate, where it's got much drier and also much wetter. Back in 2019, it was the driest year on record here, and I looked out my office window and it was just brown. The ground covers were virtually dead. The trees were hanging in there because they seemed to be able to, work well with the water stress. But other than that, it was pretty hard to look at it all. And you think one match and this whole place would go up in flames. And then we get to this year and it's just so much water, you just don't know how it could happen. It's just the whole farm is completely soaked. And it survived not too bad, except there was some erosion on some of the trees. This year has probably been the wettest year on record. We've had 3 metres of rain, which is more than twice the rain that we normally get in a so-called average season. It has certainly put the farm under a great deal of stress. It's shown my weaknesses in my farming practices. I've had some sheet erosion under some large trees where I didn't have complete ground cover, and I've now have exposed roots, which need repairing. The wet weather decimated the insect population. We did what's called a soil health card check, where you actually dig out a square of soil and count the number of earthworms. And we did it a few months ago, or a month or so ago, and there was zero. Unbelievable, I couldn't believe there was no worms in that top layer. Just so much rain, it's been really destructive, and also beneficial insects across the whole orchard. I had to spray for macadamia lace bug this year because there was no beneficials there to give them a hard time. They've come back quite quick now. They're really building now.
You've really got a feel for these farmers. Often we hear so much about drought and no rain, and then this smashing that they got with rain is devastating on the other scale.
What we'd want to highlight with Ross is that they had over 3 metres of rainfall, and the impact that has on a property is that it caused severe erosion And one of the sort of responses he's had to that is that he really wants really strong ground cover to hold his soil in place and prevent the trees and the trees' roots losing the soil, losing the stability, because it's quite a hilly terrain. And by introducing these diverse cover crops within the rows, something there is going to survive those wet periods and dry periods. So you've got a diversity of species that's able to retain ground cover, retain soil, prevent erosion.
Let's hear a little bit more from Ross about some of the changes he's made on the farm.
Over the last 7 years, I've made two major changes to my orchard practices to help with these changes in the climate. I've opened up my canopies to let more light through my trees, and I've grown cover crops. And this practice has allowed more insect diversity in the orchard and also more soil biology. The cover crops add that diversity with plants that also bring in more insects. It also adds more diversity below the ground with the soil biology and drives that process along, which makes it more resilient to climatic conditions where it's much drier those years and when it's much wetter other years. And then with canopy management, if I open up my trees and keep them small, it allows more sun through, and sunlight's the key to all this. If we have more sun coming through, we grow more nut. We also put more sun on the ground and keep the cover crops growing, and we get 100% ground cover.
To get a better idea of what the cover crops are looking like, how he's set it up, Ross took us out amongst the macadamias and we had a closer look.
I have two distinct parts to my orchard floor. There's the part near the tree where the sweeper of the harvester goes. So that needs to be kind of a low growing, tightly knitted ground cover so no soil is removed. So what I'm trying to get is the basket grass here, dichondra and broadleaf carpet grass. These allow the harvester to pull the nut out quite easily, but also stop erosion from happening around the base of the tree there. From the ground cover near the tree, I then move out to the cover crop section of the orchard, which is done in autumn and spring. It always has a bit of like buckwheat in it, phacelia, flax, different clovers, lucerne, cowpea, chicory, and maybe a little bit of brassicas, maybe a bit of radish or turnip in that mix. So between these two mixes I've used, where we've got these ground covers growing near the tree for harvest, the cover crop mix in the middle is more to bring beneficial insects in, also for that soil health building with the different soil microbiome. And those two parts of the orchard are quite different, but they work together to make that whole process work.
Now, the cover crops are just one aspect to the resilience that Ross has been working on. If you want to find out more about the other techniques he's been putting in place, click on the links in the show notes and you can read about his case study and watch a video as well. His attitude towards farming is a really positive one, which is really exciting to hear.
I love my job. I'm in a rush to get out of bed every day and get out in the paddock. You know, it's about making it a better farm all the time, a more diverse farm, a more resilient farm. I want to spray less, so I'm putting less poison out there that affects my neighbours and my own family. And I just want to make it a better process. My aim with the farm is to make it as sustainable as possible, where it's resilient to all these weather changes we get. And it's just helping with climate change. I'm sequestering more carbon and growing better food for people, for better health. You know, I just want a system that's highly complex and me just to put in simplistic little changes to help along that whole dynamic, making the farm work.
That's really exciting to hear. Obviously, Ross has put a lot of work into building resilience in his farm, but he's now then just tweaking things and working with the system to make positive changes, to increase diversity, improve resilience, and make his farm a better place, one macadamia tree at a time.
I had a macadamia tree in my yard when I was a kid, and it was fantastic to get out the little cracker, to slowly twist it down until you crack the nut.
Fun memories. We're going yes, back yeah, in time.
Yeah. I didn't get any samples from Ross, so I should have hit him up for some.
Yeah. Ross, if you're listening to this podcast, Matt's after a few macadamia nuts. So if you can send them his way, that'd be great. So we're jumping back in the car again and heading from far north Lismore all the way down to a beautiful town called Wombat. When I heard about we were going to Wombat, I was very excited. And more excited when I heard that we were going to go and visit a cherry orchard. Who doesn't love cherries, Matt?
You can't not like cherries, surely.
It's un-Australian. We're going to go and visit Chris and Lee Hall from Hall Cherries, and really wonderful farm that has, I guess, really pushed the boundaries of doing things differently in the cherry industry, trying to be resilient to climate, reducing their inputs and working more with nature.
Hi, I'm Chris Hall from Hall Family Orchards.
Hi, I'm Lee Hall, and our farm is based at Wombat, which is 18 kilometres from Young.
So Hall Family Orchards is a cherry orchard and a sheep enterprise. At Cherries, we have 20 hectares of orchard, which is about 9,000 cherry trees, and we run about 200 Aussie white ewes on about 200 acres. It keeps us busy and gives us a little bit of diversification. We originally came from a larger orchard, so we've downsized and we're really trying to focus on quality and flavour.
So I think for us it's really exciting to be selling direct to the consumer and getting feedback on what they like, what they don't like.
We have about 10 main varieties and we've got about 4 in trial at the moment. Always trying to update to find varieties that can handle the weather more. I've had my own cherry orchard for over 25 years now. I'm definitely worried that in the last few years that I'm seeing more extremes. We've come out of 2 years of really bad drought where I did lose 2 hectares of older trees that I was running low on water, I had to turn it off. Last year we had record rains and we got hail 4 times last year, but it's really impacted our business now because the rest of the orchard's quite young and still developing. We had to battle through last year. Quite a few varieties we couldn't pick, and there was others that had really bad damage, up to 40 and 50% damage, which hard to pay the bills when you get that much damage.
It's been pretty full on, I think, for both of us. I think we've just had to adapt and just keep going on.
For Chris and Lee, the last few years have really impacted their farm and their finances. And it's forced them to think creatively about how to build resilience into the landscape and their cash flow.
Our focus over the last decade really is just to see where we can build our resilience and be able to absorb some of the storms or whether we absorb the droughts, and not spending too much on inputs and having that pressure of trying to recover some of those input costs. They can be quite high, so we're trying to balance lowering the inputs and letting nature take over. So we've really focused on our soil and collecting rainfall when we can with better infiltration, like better organic matter and more diversity in the soil. The microbes help to aerate the soil and the worms and the insects digging up the soil. So that was one of our focus. The other focus is really trying to increase the diversity of plant numbers and flowering plants and trees, shrubs, so that helps diverse bird life and then it helps a diverse insect life.
For Chris, that biodiverse ecosystem starts from the ground up with microbiology in the soil, which he's been studying and observing for over 20 years. He's done many different courses over the years, and when we were there at the farm, he even showed us his microscope that he uses to get a closer look at the billions of bugs in the soil. And key to encouraging the microbial activity in the soil is applying natural fertilizers, and he does this in the form of compost.
Some of the products we're buying weren't the level that we thought they were, so now I'm making my own compost and trying to get that diverse group of microbes in a compost that I can then go and spread out onto the soil. We also have our own worm farm that we put some waste into it, the household waste and wood chips and out of the orchard. That goes into that as well. It doesn't need to be a lot of compost. I'll use, say, 10 kilos and that can do up to 10 hectares. So it can go a long way. I put it into a 1,000-litre container and I bubble air through it and try to extract the microbes off the compost and turn that into a liquid tea or a liquid extract, and then I go out and spray that onto the grass or onto the cherries, and they play a really key function. I suppose it works a little bit like the insects. You're trying to build up the beneficial insects. In the microbes, you're doing the same. You're building up all the beneficials to eat the bad guys. The benefits of using this is that we can cut down on the fertilizer needs. The fertilizer's uptaken more efficiently, so there's savings in trying to be more efficient with fulvic acid, better uptake. So we utilize that with a little bit of fertilizer, so it saves us money in buying fertilizers, plus it's buffers against any problems. Yeah, so there is savings to be had by using the microbes to basically bring in those nutrients to break down the minerals in the soil and naturally start releasing that into the soil. And yeah, so that's the goal, is to reduce our inputs.
As well as making inputs more efficient, microbiology is actually able to help the plants access more water that's stored in the soil that they wouldn't otherwise be able to access.
The plants can access about 30% of the water in the soil, whereas microbes can access in between the particles and in the soils that the roots can't access and open up another 20 or 30% or more water. So, yeah, we've taken photos of a cover crop in one paddock, and on the fence on the other side, paddock's starting to dry off and run out of moisture, but a meter out from the cover crop, still as green as anything, and the cover crop's going strong, it's still green. So you can see things like that where the microbes can certainly access a lot more, which is pretty handy in a drought.
As well as microbes contributing to soil and plant health, Chris is also focusing on the role that fungus plays in connecting the biodiversity across his landscape.
Fungus in the soil, I think, is a really important aspect. Building those little fibrous networks that act like a root system. So the roots might reach so far, a couple of meters or several meters, but the fungus can reach hundreds of meters, they've proven that it can go kilometers even. So, and they do network up with other trees and other plants. So having different diversity is really important. Some plants might pull up calcium, other plants might bring up more zinc and sulfur and make it more available. So having all those different plants collecting different nutrients, everything's about working together.
And it's taken a number of years to get this gradual change happening, but the improvements in microbiology in the soil have allowed Chris and Lee to shift away from chemicals in their system.
We're not having to put as many inputs in fertilizer. We've cut all our chemicals. Like, it was a slow transition away from chemicals and testing different things and being brave and bold not to put insecticides on when, you've got a problem, and trying to let everything balance out, Mother Nature take its course. I think a lot of the insect problems that I've seen over my lifetime are getting worse and worse because people were using chemicals. It was actually creating more of a problem. We're getting more earwigs and we're getting more cherry slug, and they're the two main ones in cherries, and thrips. And they just seem to be getting worse and worse because people kept spraying. And that was one of the reasons why we wanted to go chemical free, get away from that. And as we got away from it, we noticed those levels were all under control. Every so often you get a little bit of an outbreak, but if you be patient, which sometimes takes a bit of guts to sit back and watch, but you eventually see those other beneficial insects taking over. And the reason we have flowers there is when they don't have anything to eat, other insects to eat, they live off the nectar of the flowers. So that's why having lots of flowers and the diversity in the orchard all works hand in hand.
Working our way up the biodiversity food chain, as Chris builds up the diversity of his microbes and insects, he's also starting to see a diversity of birds in the orchard.
Most people laugh at me when I say I want more birds in the orchard, because everyone associates more birds with eating cherries, and our biggest pest is starlings. They just camp out there and they're hard to move on, and big numbers, they can be in a couple of hundred at a time, and they're a bit harder to move. So my goal is to introduce birds of prey. So I need some smaller birds, nectar birds, and things that birds of prey might prey on. So trying to build up that diversity for them to move in and hopefully starlings might move out if I've got birds of prey in there. I probably need some wedge-tailed eagles or something a bit more scary to scare them right off. But yeah, things are changing. It's cool.
We've heard from Chris and Lee, they've been trying lots of little different things over many years, but what's brought it all together is kind of stepping back and looking at these changes from a whole of farm perspective, and that's helped them to think about biodiversity when it comes to planting out their species of grasses and plants and shrubs and trees. And what they're building is resilience across the whole farm.
Yeah, trying to build up the diversity and build up the insects, and we're using the grasses and the flowers as a starting approach. And I'm hoping to start to build out shrubs and understory trees would be the next step. 15 to 20 years ago, I did a lot of tree planting with all forestry trees plus some native trees to this area, and just trying to get a bit of diversity happening in some of our low-lying countries, our gullies, and fencing off and protecting certain areas of the farm. And in those plantings, we also tried a lot of shrubs as well, but I really like to boost up more shrubs if I can, understory trees. And we've always kept trees away from the orchard a little bit because we didn't want the birds to come in. So now I might start to introduce some trees and shrubs a little bit closer to the orchard. So especially the shrubs to get the smaller birds and the nectar-eating birds and things like that. And also the insects, the beneficial insects, close to the orchard where they can have the most impact. So yeah, it's a whole farm approach.
What we really saw there was that Chris in particular has taken a really holistic approach to encouraging the whole ecosystem biodiversity. And in doing that, he's then allowed the removal of several high-cost inputs. So he's improved his margins, but he's also, by taking these steps, he's maximized the flavor of his cherries and the quality. And that's what they're really, yeah, sort of selling themselves on now, is that by removing these sort of synthetic and chemical inputs, they've been able to improve the quality. He's really taken it as, I'm going to scale those back, and then to the point where he's been able to remove those because he's been able to use ecosystem and the biodiversity to play the role that those used to play. And he's been targeted and scientific about his approaches and how those biodiversity aspects get integrated into the ecosystem and into his sort of farm operation.
Yeah, well, let's hear a little bit more about how this shift away from chemical inputs has actually contributed to the quality of his end product.
There's a lot of management we do on that side of things to get away from the chemicals. And the worst about the chemicals is, especially fungicides, they actually drop the Brix levels. So they drop the sugar levels, and that's part of the reason why we can get better flavour. The microbes offer something that we can't really supply in the way of flavour. There's a lot of secondary metabolites that they provide the tree that offer that extra flavour. But nutrition-wise, we can get more flavour by balancing things out. High nitrate levels also weakens the flavour, makes it fruit bitter. And that's used a lot in the commercial industry to get growth and production, because growers get paid on production, whereas our production may not be quite as high just yet. Hopefully in the future, when the whole system is really well balanced, we might be different, but we lack a bit in production at the moment, but we're gaining in flavour. And down the track, hopefully that's returned customers back to us.
Well, I think the way Chris is growing cherries now has improved the flavour of the cherries significantly. And you know, when customers come through, that they are repeat customers because they just love the flavour, and they know that they're going to get a really nice cherry that's full of nutrients and it's got no chemicals, but it's just got that flavour they're not tasting in other fruit that they might be eating cherries on the market.
Matt, what's really amazing to hear is that the microbiology in the soil is feeding the cherry flavour. That's really exciting. Yep. So every time you bite into those Christmas cherries, you can think of the microbes that are enhancing the flavour.
I watched a video recently that showed like mycelium transferring carbon. And yeah, it's an incredible ecosystem that lives under the soil that's completely or almost completely invisible. It's not until you see something like that where someone's actually put it under a microscope, and that stuff that Chris was doing.
It's really inspiring to hear all these farmers' stories of changing not only their practices, but it's their mindsets, you know, to sort of sometimes even in some cases go against tradition and what's always been done in previous generations. And that can be a real challenge, but it's really exciting to hear these stories. And I guess we hope that people listening will be spurred on and feel confident that they can also try these new things. There are people doing it and succeeding.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The impression you get is that a lot of them started this because it felt good. You know, they got a good feeling from supporting the biodiversity and removing the inputs that they were using, not just because it meant that their margins were better, they weren't having to spend the money, but they were then sort of preserving whatever life was there already and not wiping it out with some sort of chemical, which sounds very, you know, airy-fairy, I guess, but they've done it and they've done it successfully.
And if you want to find out more about the broader practice changes that these farmers have tried, we'll put links in the show notes to the three farmers you've heard today, but also you'll be able to find a whole bunch of other farmer stories as part of this series that we've gone on, and read their stories and watch the film so you can actually see what they've done on their farms. So, Matt, next episode, we're looking at livestock management and going to visit a couple of farms. Any teasers you want to give our listeners?
Well, I guess, you know, what's been really interesting from a lot of the livestock producers is the different techniques that they're bringing into their operations to improve how they operate, improve their efficiencies. They're all, you know, quite different, the techniques that they've used, but they've been extremely effective. And where we've seen them in action, and you can too if you have a look at the videos, you know, these properties are functioning beautifully. So it's been enlightening to get out and see them.
Awesome. Looking forward to getting on the road. I've got to come up with another playlist to listen to on these long road trips that we're making.
More podcast homework.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you.
The Big Shift podcast is proudly produced by Grow Love Project. And this special edition Farmer Stories series has been funded through the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries Climate Change Research Strategy. Thanks to all the farmers who've generously shared their time and their stories. If you like what you heard, please share it, and thanks for listening.